Accession number 27208, Reel 1.
Bill Reid, Reel 1. Bill, can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
Edinburgh in 1923.
What date?
23rd of January.
And what did your father do for a living?
He was an advocate in Edinburgh. He was in the First World War. He too was a Lieutenant RNVR, but he was blown up in a ship in Leith Harbour. He wasn't killed, but he was never properly able to work again after that.
What caused the explosion?
A nice hot day. Engineer was fiddling with a magneto in the engine room of this motor launch that he was in command of. And at the time they were loading fuel. And so the spark ignited the fuel and he was blown up through the chart room roof. It didn't do much good. Spent a fortnight in hospital, unconscious, after having tried to swim. No, he didn't swim. He finished up in the sea, in the harbour.
Mm-hmm. And what about your mother? Did she work? Or?
No, she didn't. No. She just looked after me and the other three sisters that I had.
What about the family home? What was that like?
In Edinburgh, it was one of the tall Georgian houses in a place called Drummond Place, in the new town of Edinburgh. And it was really very nice. But after his accident, his fortunes declined. And so we lived in various places after that. And for a long period in Glasgow, in a house that was fundamentally owned by my father's family. And some of them were still there. So it was not quite so comfortable as the nice house in Edinburgh had been.
What about your education?
I don't suffer from a very comprehensive, well, a very, very thorough education. We moved around quite a bit. I remember the first school I was at was called St. Oran's in Drummond Place. I'm not sure I wasn't expelled from that for jumping up and down on the table and shouting, "I'm my mummy's big tumphy." And so that didn't go down too well. But when we came to Glasgow, I went to a state school in Pollokshields in Glasgow, and then on to Allan Glen's school and to do my secondary education. But when I was about 16, I suppose, the war started, and I sort of lost interest in education a bit after that.
Considering what happened to you in your wartime career, did you have any interest in aviation at all?
Not really, no. Not really.
The Navy?
Yes, I liked the Navy. Spending my formative years in Glasgow, and indeed some years in a town called Helensburgh, which is a watering place in about 20 or 30 miles from Glasgow, and which is a paradise for teenage boys, because you could canoe on the river and get into the hills and ski and that sort of thing. Great place. Not far from the Highlands. And so I liked that very much. I went to school there, in a school called the Hermitage.
While you were at school, you sound like you were quite active in some of your recreational pursuits. Was there anything that particularly interested you at the time? Any sports?
Oh, not really. No, not desperately keen in team sports. Play golf now, but I didn't learn that till I was about 30, which is far too late. No, I wasn't very terribly sporting at school. Played hockey a bit. Did a bit of rugby, but not to any significant extent.
Did you ski? Yes, I
used to ski in Scotland, but that was after the war. Scottish skiing is not quite like it is in the Alps. The Scottish Ski Club has a little rhyme, if I can remember it. We ski on grass, we ski on heather, we ski in every sort of weather, But when we ski on rocks and muddy pools, we're bloody fools. But it's good fun, nevertheless, being out in the fresh air in the mountains. I've always loved skiing.
So is the 30s going on, and obviously you were quite young at the time, but did you have any sort of anticipation of what was happening in Europe at the time?
Didn't loom large in the mind, really. I mean, the papers did have things about Hitler. Used to notice that the Japanese used to come around the Clyde a lot with the cameras and photographing everything in sight. But it wasn't a large part of life at that time.
And did you hear Chamberlain's declaration of war at all?
Yes. Mm. Well, that certainly concentrated the mind a bit.
What were the circumstances? Can you remember?
No, I don't. No.
So obviously, once the war occurred, were you still at school?
Yes.
That first period. Were there any immediate kind of changes in September of 39 to your daily life?
Not that I can remember, not really. At first, well, it was the phony war, wasn't it? And things were much the same for the first year. And rationing came in and so on. And then I was called up after a bit.
How did that go? How did that occur? Because did you have a choice in who you wanted to be called up for or what you wanted to enlist in?
Well, like many of my young chums, I thought it'd be the fashionable thing to do, I suppose, to join the Air Force. So I applied to join the Air Force, and they sent me through to Edinburgh from Glasgow. And there I was interviewed by an Air Commodore. And the Air Commodore said, well, I think you're too studious a chap to go flying, so we won't have you, thank you very much. So I just hung on until I was called up. And when I was called up, I expressed a preference for the Navy. And they sent me down to HMS Ganges at Shotley Pier near Ipswich. And there I did my basic training with a lot of rough boys, some rougher than me even.
Were you a boy seaman at the time then, as such?
Not such, no. Ganges had been a boys' training establishment, but I wasn't a boy seaman. I was hostilities only, I suppose.
So the establishment had changed as the war had been declared. It had gone
yes.
boys to a training establishment rather than a boy seaman's
yes.
training
yeah.
establishment. Can you remember what your reception was like as you arrived at Ganges?
No, I don't really. I remember it was a very unpleasant journey getting to it, because I'd never been out of Scotland, so I got my railway warrant and I had to go to London, and finding my way through London and onto a train to Ganges was a bit tricky. I just remember it was a very forbidding looking sort of place. You know, it looked like sort of abandon hope all ye who enter here sort of place.
What was accommodation like for the recruits?
Adequate, but basic.
What was it then?
Large huts with about, I can't remember the number, something between 12 and 20 men, I expect. Iron bedsteads.
And what about food and rations, that type of thing? Was that adequate or suitable?
Adequate, but not gourmet standard. They fed you. Well, they fed you quite well. They were very nice. The instructors were very pleasant because you came there a bit fearful of what was happening and so on. But they were really very, very nice, and it was a very good instruction.
What was discipline like at Ganges?
Not so strict, perhaps, as I might have assumed. Nobody got the cat of nine tails, as far as I remember. There was an officer, first lieutenant, I suppose, who walked around with a cane and black leggings, of whom everyone was terrified. But I don't think they really had need to be. He was not an unkind man. It wasn't too bad.
And how did you take to naval life Did you take to it instantly, or did you enjoy the experience?
Oh, that part of it was just something that one had to undergo. I didn't really enjoy it very much. Like sailing the, we used to go out in naval rowing boats, cutters and whalers. I liked that bit. But learning about things like the Vickers gas-operated machine gun with the rear sear retainer keeper and leg was, I thought, a bit unnecessary.
Did you have to do drill there as well?
Oh, indeed. Oh, yes. I enjoyed that, too.
Did you? It sounds like you took to it. Did everybody take to it so easily with drill?
As far as I remember, yes. I think so. And there was a canteen, and we used to drink a lot of beer. Whose beer was it? It was good beer. That's where a lot of us learned to drink beer, I'm afraid. Never forgot the trick.
What other types of training did you have? You mentioned, obviously, a little bit of the weapons training. Was it machine guns, or did you do rifle shooting or anything of that order?
No, I don't remember doing rifle shooting. No, I don't. And we didn't do any machine gun shooting either. It was just learning about them. We had ship recognition. I don't really remember very much about what we did do. There's quite a lot of square bashing. Yeah.
Did you learn knots at that stage?
Yes, we did. Yeah, I enjoyed that too, actually. I still teach my grandchildren how to do that, although the Turk's head escapes me.
How did they teach you knots? What was the process of actually teaching somebody knots?
Oh, well, I've forgotten that, I'm afraid. I suppose they gave you a piece of rope and said, tie this, and this is the way you do it.
So would I be right in thinking that the emphasis on this stage was kind of just purely basic drill and very elemental seamanship kind of?
Yes, yes. And history, a history of the Navy taught us that. But it wasn't academic.
And at this stage, were you offered any opportunities to obviously go into the, you went into the Fleet Air, but were you given the opportunity at that stage to say, that's what I want to do?
Well, they came round, and somebody came round, I think, I seem to remember, and asked for volunteers for the Fleet Air Arm. And I thought, that's not a bad idea, so I'll have a go at that.
In a sense, was that combining your initial interest in joining the RAF with Navy?
Well, you know what small boys are like. They like the thought of being engine drivers or aeroplane pilots or something, so I thought it'd be a good idea.
Where did you go to once the basic training had finished? What was the next stage?
HMS St Vincent at Gosport. There was an indoctrination to the Fleet Air Arm there. And you wore a same uniform, but you had a white cap badge, because by that time you were officer cadet. And we did square bashing, of course, history of the Navy and all that stuff. But I don't really remember much of what else we learned. I remember everybody, of course, in the Fleet Air Arm remembers Chief Petty Officer Wilmot, who must have been spoken. You must have heard a great deal.
Well, can you
about
tell me some more
Chief
about him? What you remember of him?
Well, he was, I do believe, he had been a postman in civil life. He was not a tall man. He didn't dress very. He wasn't very carefully dressed. He was a wee bit on the scruffy side, slightly scabby. His teeth were terrible. He was not tall, but when I remember standing in front of him and being disciplined for some offence, minor offence, and his words and his manner of delivery were such that he had my knees shaking like a jelly. He was a wonderful disciplinarian. And again, I knew afterwards he was an extremely kind man. But it's the job of officers, of chief petty officers and people of that kind, to instill in people the sort of discipline that will mean that if you've got to be more afraid of the officers than you are of the enemy. And he certainly achieved that very well, regarded with great affection by many. But as to what we were taught, I don't remember very much about it. I think it was more or less an extension of what we'd done in the basic training.
There was was there any elements of flying training or ground lectures at that stage that you would?
Yes, we had aircraft recognition as well as ship recognition, but I don't remember much of what we were taught.
How important really. Is aircraft and ship recognition within the fleet air arm? Is it an important thing?
Vital, yeah. If you don't learn these things properly, you get lots of friendly fire, don't you? Because people are shooting their own people because they can't recognise the aeroplanes or the ships, for that matter. It is vitally important.
How long roughly was the course while you were at St Vincent? Was it a long course or?
There again, I'm not very sure. I would say probably something between 8 and 12 weeks, I think. Something like that.
And how did you feel about the prospect of being able to fly with this little
aircraft? Oh, I looked forward to that.
So where did you go next after you'd finished there? Because I assume you would have started your flying training fairly...
I better tell you about how I got into the fleet arm in the first place, because I had to go for another interview to get into the fleet air arm from Ganges. And I got to this place which... I think it was in Wales. It was a long way away, anyway. Together with other young aspiring officers, and we were put into an anteroom, awaiting our turn to be interviewed. And I didn't know what to say. And I turned to a chap sitting beside me. I said to this chap, "I don't know what to say when they ask me if you want to join the fleet arm." What should I say? Oh, he said, you say to them, he said, "I'm madly keen to fly and hack down the Hun." So when I got into the interview, I said, "I'm madly keen to fly, sir, and hack down the Hun." So I got in. That's fine. A bit different from nowadays, I think.
So
anyway,
again from St Vincent, did you go on to your basic line training then? Was that the next stage?
Yes, we were trained by the RAF, and I was sent to Elmdon for basic flying training, Tiger Moths.
Can you give me some idea of the pattern of training, how it took place, what the kind of sequence of instruction that you would get on a Tiger Moth, the kind of from the first steps to the kind of things that you would have to learn?
It was very capable and very thorough instruction, and the instructors, I remember, were extremely good. And I remember one instructor, the first instructor I had, took me up, and I think this was his standard practice, took me up in his Tiger Moth before we'd started proper training, and threw it all over the sky. And I think that was the test. If you could withstand that, he would carry on training you. And in fact, I did very well in that course, and got to... I met that instructor 50 years later. And he said, "You're one of my star pupils," he said. I never thought that at the time. Nobody told me that.
with the instruction that you were given, I take it the kind of that was a familiarisation of flying and what it's like to be in an aircraft. Did they take it then from a very basic level onwards? What would be the kind of first things you would learn?
Well, a Tiger Moth... It was a two-seater, and the instructor sits in the front, I think, and the pupil sits in the back, I think. And you do familiarization, which is just you get into the air, and the instructor hands the controls over to you, and you fly it straight and level. And as you get used to the ability to keep the thing doing the right thing in the straight and level mode, as the exercises progress, you get more and more interesting things to do. You get spinning, recovery from a spin, for instance, very important. You get, eventually, you get aerobatics, loops and rolls and rolls off the top and things like that, which is great fun, of course, especially in a tiger moth with the wind whistling around your ears. And there's a whole list of things that you have to complete and be signed out as being competent to do these various exercises before you're allowed eventually to go solo. And you do night flying as well. And then, of course, the great day comes after some, probably about 12 hours or thereabouts, 8, 10 to 12, something like that. And you go solo. Because the great thing is circuits and bumps, of course, you do a lot of those. But if the instructor's satisfied that you can do it, then he gets out and says, it's all yours, and off you go. And it's a very, very exciting moment. And if you don't break the thing, then that's okay. And then you carry on doing more advanced exercises. Exercises like spotting a field and seeing if you can land in that field, you know, come down and approach it in an engine failure condition. And then the instructor would open up the throttle and you would go around somewhere else.
You mentioned a couple of things there, because obviously to people who don't fly, spinning seems quite a terrifying thing. What's the instruction for getting out of a spin? What do you have to do?
Well, when an aircraft spins, it runs out of airspeed, so the lift of the wings is negated, and it just falls, and as it falls, it tends to turn. And as it turns, it revolves and falls, and the nose drops, and it is it's quite hairy, it's quite exciting. And the way to get out of it is to push the stick hard forward and push the, because it's invariably turning one way or the other, and you have to push the stick hard forward and press the opposite rudder hard to make it come out of the spin. And if you're lucky, it does. And usually, in my case, it always did. And I think in everybody's case it did, because the Tiger Moth's a very forgiving aeroplane, but they say if you can fly it well, you can fly anything.
You mentioned as well you did some kind of basic aerobatics as well. What kind of things did that entail?
Oh, loop the loop, slow rolls, and of course that's good fun, because you have to, the Tiger Moth's not greatly endowed with power, so for the loop you have to get your nose down and get adequate flying speed for the manoeuvre to be successful, and then up and over you go. And that's all right, because gravity is pressing you into your seat, or centrifugal force is pressing you into your seat as you go all the way around. But slow rolls are a bit more difficult. You have to have an adequate speed to do them again, because you need plenty of power when you're on your back. But for that, you simply revolve the aircraft around its axis until you're hanging on the straps. In that case, of course, your head is hanging on the thing, and if you hope that your straps are strong enough and properly made up, you don't fall out of the airplane. But you just roll it round by operating the controls in the way that the instructor has recommended. Good fun.
It sounds like you took to it quite quickly with flying it. Would you say that with flying it, it's as much to do with you having a feel for the aircraft as learning the processes, or is it a bit of both?
I think there's an awful lot of instinctive a feeling for it, a feeling how the aircraft responds to the various things you're asking it to do and responds to the air in which it's flying and so on. I think there's a lot of instinct in it. But you have to be taught. There's no doubt of that. You have to be properly taught. And the Air Force is extremely good at that. They did very well.
This, when you soloed, you said they obviously allowed you to go around. What were your feelings the first time you soloed the aircraft?
Oh, elation, I think. I'm sure everybody who's ever done that would think they're highly elated. Not fearful, and not... I don't think anybody would be afraid of it. But once you're off the ground and doing it, it's great. You feel you're the master of the sky doing that. Great.
And what about taking the aircraft off? What's the process of taking an aircraft off like the Tiger off? What do you have to do?
Well, you have to taxi it out from the dispersal area to the upwind end of the airfield, because you always take off and land into wind, or nearly always. And you do your cockpit checks, TMP, FF, CG. I can even remember that now.
What does that stand for?
Throttle, mixture, pitch, TMP, flaps, fuel, carburetor, heat. I can't remember what G was for. Anyway, you go through that, because all flying is going through checks nowadays. And then, it always has been. And once you've done that, you rev up the engine, and you every Tiger Moth engine, Gypsy Queen, I think, has two magnetos. And in order to check that both magnetos are successful, you have to rev up the engine to a certain rev, quite high revs, and turn off each magneto in turn. And you have a maximum amount that the propeller will be allowed to drop, below which you have to taxi back in again. But if, as a normal, it's within the parameters laid down, then you switch on both magnetos, reduce the engine power, taxi into the takeoff position facing the wind, and slowly and deliberately open the throttle, maintain your direction by using the rudders heavily at first, because there's not much wind over the rudder, and as the wind increases with speed, so you need less and less rudder movement, and as the wind increases, you press the stick forward, and that takes the tail off the ground, and the aircraft is then flying level. And when you have reached the speed that the aircraft will climb at, you gently pull the stick back, and the aircraft will carry itself and you into the air. And by use of the controls, sensibly you maintain the correct speed and climb away.
What about landing? What's the things to remember with landing?
Well, landing, you come around the circuit. Every airfield has what's known as a circuit, the interwind leg, the downwind leg, and the approach leg, crosswind leg and approach leg. And you come to the downwind leg and you look at the airfield and you think it's positioned about correctly. And once you've passed the upwind end of the runway, you start to turn a crosswind and start reducing height and speed. And then you come towards the line of the runway, you turn in towards the runway, and it should be something like 600 feet by that time from 1,000 feet around the circuit. And then you gently approach the landing spot at the upwind end of the runway, reducing your speed to the speed that the manufacturer of the aircraft recommends you should land it at. Once you get over the fence, you then, look out over the side to see, because we're always using grass fields, and it's quite useful because you looked out over the edge of the cockpit, and when you could see the individual blades of grass, you knew that you were about the right height to pull the control column back, close the throttle, and with luck, make a nice 3-point landing. Easy. Any fool can do it.